From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're broadcasting conversations with big thinkers. Novelist and poet Sherman Alexie reflects on his complicated relationship with his mother, as revealed in his book, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. But first, Susan Burton is an advocate for criminal justice reform. She's also the founder of an organization called A New Way of Life, which helps formerly incarcerated women get back on their feet. Her advocacy came as a result of her own experiences. She served 6 jail terms on drugs-related offenses following the death of her 5-year-old son. She shares her powerful story in a memoir. It's called Becoming Ms. Burton, From Prison to Recovery to Leading the Fight for Incarcerated Women. Susan Burton, an honor to have you on this program. Can I just start by saying, having met you a few years ago.
Yes.
And had you on this program before. I am so honored and just pleased and delighted to see that people are getting the work that you've been doing for some time. Yeah. And sometimes you labor in the vineyard and people never, not that it matters, because you're not doing it for the adoration.
Exactly.
You're not doing it for the adulation or the praise, but it is nice when people finally catch up to what you've been doing and how well you've been doing it. How are you handling all this Michelle Alexander, Brian Stevenson, John Legend, Nicholas Kristof love?
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
I don't do the work for recognition. Mm-hmm. I do it because it needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And somebody needs to do it. So I picked up the banner, mm-hmm, to help women escape the criminal justice system. Myself, I traveled in and out of prison for almost 2 decades, and there was no help for me, mm-hmm, until October 4th of 1997. You know, I found help in Santa Monica.
That date is etched in your brain, obviously.
October 4th, yeah, is etched in my brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. And I found that treatment in Santa Monica was much different than in South LA, mm, for, you know, a controlled substance, for addiction. And I found that in Santa Monica, and I brought it back to South LA.
Treatment is different how?
People in Santa Monica, when I was there in 1997, they weren't going to prison for being in possession of a controlled substance. They were getting a court card or being diverted to a treatment program. Mm-hmm. I can remember a young man in a 12-step meeting complaining about the color green. He had had an accident under the influence of alcohol and drugs, and his sentence was to paint the jail. My sentence was to live in the jail, much different. So when I found the support, the services, the way in which we were treated with dignity and respect, you know, I was able to begin my healing process, pick up my bed and walked. Mm. And I came back to South LA to spread that. And since then, we've helped over 1,000 women transition back into the community and reunited over 300 children with their moms. And you know, I'm happy about that.
You should be.
Yes.
I'm not naive in asking this question, but is what you saw in Santa Monica versus what you saw in South Central, was that difference based on race? Was it based on class or something I'm missing?
I think it's a mixture of race and class.
Okay.
You know, poor people aren't extended the services that wealthy people, or poor people can't buy the services, mm-hmm, that wealthy people can. So, you know, I got a lucky break to be able to enter into that community and be supported and experience what I experienced there. And the luck just didn't stop with me. Mm-hmm. I had to extend that to other people, other women.
So because, help me understand this piece.
Yes.
Because you're operating in a judicial system, in a criminal justice system, that whether it says it does or doesn't, does in fact see race.
It does.
Because you're operating in that system, when you say you brought what you saw in Santa Monica back to South Central, you may have brought some good ideas back, but you're still dealing with black and brown sisters.
Yes.
So how did you get the respect for them because they're still black and brown.
Yes.
That the people in that the good white folk were getting in Santa Monica.
Right. Well, I'm an advocate. Okay. I'm an activist. And through the years, you know, I've carved out a certain level of respect for Ms. Burton. Mm-hmm. And that's in the judicial system, throughout our legislative offices. And
you were just in Sacramento right here.
I just came back from Sacramento.
Yeah. Doing some lobbying.
Doing some lobbying, yeah. Talking about jury service. Mm-hmm. You know, I still can't serve on a jury. And how does a person from my community...
And you actually want to.
I want to. I want to.
Yeah.
You know, I want to...
I ain't mad at you.
Hey, hey, I want to serve on a jury.
Right.
And I want my community to be able to fully participate in, mm-hmm. in civic activities. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have my time.
Yeah.
I rehabilitated myself and 1,000 other women. You know, we're fit for jury service.
And what did you hear in Sacramento when you made your plea?
A few legislators said that when I testified, they got a whole different picture and a whole different thought about, mm-hmm. you know, what we're doing here in America, mm-hmm. how we're continuing to punish people, and they passed it. Mm-hmm. So it got passed through one committee. It got a couple of more committees to do, and
I'll
be knocking on some doors. It made it out of committee.
High five on that.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That's how the process starts.
Yes.
One committee at a time. I want people to get the full measure, and they're going to get it when they read the book.
Yes.
I want them to get more of the full measure of what you were going through during that 20-year period.
Yeah.
So tell me how you got into the spot you were in, why you stayed in there, why you couldn't get out. And I was fascinated and just blown away. Quite frankly, it was arresting to read this passage in your book where there was one prison official who said to you, we're going to hold your spot.
Yeah.
We know you're coming back.
You're coming back.
They would tell you, Susan, we're going to hold a spot for you, honey, because we know you're coming back.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you have people expecting you to be recidivist.
The whole system set up for you to return.
Yeah.
So, Tavis, my son, he was 5. Mm-hmm. His name was KK. We called him KK. He was killed. He was killed by a police officer. He ran him over. My son was playing in the street. It was an accident. But my world just crumbled. I began to drink, and that escalated to drug use, and I was incarcerated for the drug use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, long before my son was killed, though, you know, I had endured so many experiences that were just really hard and traumatic, you know, all sorts of abuse. But my son's death just mm-hmm. kind of knocked me over, and I was incarcerated for that drug use. No one ever said, you're not a bad person, you're a sick person,
mm-hmm.
you have trauma. I remember going in front of the judge and laying it all out for him and asking for help. And that judge sent me to prison for 2 years. And over and over and over again. So when I reached Santa Monica, that was just a lucky break.
Mm-hmm.
Had I not gotten that break, I don't know where I'd be or what could have happened. And, you know, since then, I've committed and dedicated my life to helping women in the pain, the suffering, the trauma, the abuse of incarceration. And yes, I left the prison and I said to the guard, you know, I'm going to get a job and I'm going to get it together. And he replied to me, only job you're going to get is in prison. There are no jobs out there for you. I'll keep your bed because you'll be back. And
how'd that make you feel?
It hurt. It hurt to hear him say that, but it hurt even more to understand the challenge that laid in front of me trying to make a successful reentry with no supports, no resources, no ID, no place to live. You know, it hurt. But I'm light years away from that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not back. And a lot of other women aren't back also because of a new way of life.
Mm-hmm. You do such great work But because you're human, because we're all human, we're not human and divine.
Right.
Has it been difficult staying on the straight and narrow for you?
So, I have a cause. You know, I have a commitment to that cause. It's not difficult staying on the straight and narrow. You know, I have a passion and a connection that's centered so deep inside of me that I wake up and do this work with so much joy and so much satisfaction. So it's not. Some of my colleagues tell me, girl, take a break. Mm-hmm. Girl, slow down. I love what I do. Mm-hmm. I take a break occasionally. But there's so much joy in seeing a person come into realizing their worth, their value, their potential, and begin to give that out just as I've, you know, seeded it into the world. So I love it. I love it. In the story, the prologue, I talk about Ingrid. And Ingrid turned to me one day and said, Miss Burton, I'm getting my life back. You know, she got all her four children back. She's in her house. She's working a job, and it's beyond a minimum wage job. She's earning an income as a single mom. And if we don't support that coming to be, we lose America's treasures in the people, which just need some support, just need a hand up. Mm-hmm. Not a hand out, but a hand up. And that's what I do.
Once a mother, always a mother.
Yes.
So I can only imagine that even all these years later, you still think about KK.
I think about KK.
What do you think?
I wonder what he'd be right now. So KK would be 40 years old right now. And I wonder what he would be to calm that question. You know, sometime I can just feel him giggling and smiling down on me and rallying me on in the heavens. But there are times that I wonder, you know, what he would be doing now, how his life would have been. And I wonder if he would be a male statistic in the criminal justice system, or would he have been able to get into a university and go on to do things? So I wonder which side he would have landed on. I know coming from a community like South LA, he would have had to fight hard not to become one of those statistics. Yeah. But anything is possible where there's life. But, you know, he's gone now.
He is gone now. And I can't imagine that there is any pain greater than the pain of a parent losing a child, because it ain't supposed to be that way.
It's not.
So I can't imagine, Susan, there's any pain greater than that. And I hope you'll take the point I'm trying to make here and the question I want to ask. So I would not wish that pain on anybody. You just gave a list of things that you wondered about KK.
Yeah.
I wonder if that hadn't tragically happened to KK, whether or not you'd be doing the work that you're doing now, because you wouldn't have walked the journey that you've walked, and all of these women and their babies who you've helped to save and to rescue.
Yeah.
I wonder if that, I mean, we just never know the journey that God has laid out for us. You ever think about that?
I do think about that. And through, you know, there, there's this passage in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says, I will not regret the past, nor close the door on it, and that I will see how my experience can benefit others. What I know is that I couldn't take back the years that I traveled in and out of the criminal justice system, but I could stop another woman and support her to not go back. Don't have the power to bring my son back, but I could support another woman to get her child back. And that's what I do. So, you know, that's sort of the the relief and satisfaction. You know, there's times when I have 8 or 10 little children running around those homes. And I know that we've been able to get those children back with their mothers. So that's the sort of satisfaction that's mended with the loss of my one child has multiplied into 300 children. And there's enough love and support for all those 300, you know, brewing up out of me. So
tell me, I don't want to color this question deliberately, but since you went there, because I want to get there anyway, just tell me something about love, what you've learned about love, what love means to you, how you practice love, how you live love. Just talk to me about love, the power of love.
The power of love. I see it as the most powerful emotion in the universe. And it has the ability, when it's flowing strong, to do so many things, so many good things. It's just one of those, it's the emotion, love, and on the other side, forgiveness. You know, out of forgiveness comes this great space for love. I had to go back and I had to forgive all of those characters in that book in order to get the power to love and move on. So for me, love is just abundant. It doesn't run out. The more you give it, the more you get to give. And you know, I love my life, I love others' lives, and I love loving. And so, yeah.
Let's talk about forgiveness, because we live in a world, certainly in our society, everybody throws the word love around. So we all talk about love, but nobody ever wants to talk about forgiveness. And I raise that because it seems to me, I was just in a conversation with some friends about this the other day, we so scarcely want to tackle the subject of forgiveness that when we see it, it just arrests us. Because we don't seem to get a glimpse of it often enough. So that when we see an example like Nelson Mandela, it just blows us away. Not that we're not capable of that same kind of forgiveness in our own lives, but we just practice that emotion, that character trait doesn't reside in us in the way that it should, so that when we see it again, it just blows us away. It floors us, because we're like, wow, can you believe the way he forgave? Can you believe the way she forgave? So what have you learned about forgiveness?
I mean, for me to forgive, I had to go deep. Because it's something that's not taught in our society. But a burden in forgiving is lifted from me and out of me. So I'm not so much forgiving for the other person
as you are for yourself,
as I am for myself. I don't need to walk around holding a heavy burden because of what someone's done. I need to forgive. I need to let go. None of us are perfect human beings. We all make mistakes. But I want to live. I want to love. And if the burden of unforgiveness, the vengeance, you know, that we carry for retribution, you know, I don't need to go back and make you pay for anything. You know, I just need to live my life for the to the fullest. So I had to forgive the policeman that killed my son. It was an accident, even though it cut like cut me wide open, and I bled everywhere. You know, I had to heal, and in forgiving is healing. For me, and I hope for the other person.
I have a friend named Wendy who always says that you have to forgive to live.
Yes.
That's her motto. She wrote a book about it. You have to forgive
to live. Yes. When I began my process of forgiveness, there's a whole type of light and abundance that flowed into me and flowed, my path just flowed with guidance and abundance.
Given that you've been doing this work for so long now.
Yes.
And given that you've had to forgive a lot of people.
Yes.
Have you or do you run into some of the same people in the work that you do now that you saw when either you were in prison or going through those difficult prisons? You ever run into those folks?
I run into those folks.
And what happens when you see them, when they see you?
They're blown away.
Yeah.
You know, there's this song, If My Friends Could See Me Now.
Oh, Lord, yes.
That old gang of mine.
Uh-huh.
They're blown away.
Yeah.
And they're awestruck
mm-hmm.
From those days to who I've become today, Miss Burton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's got to feel good.
Yeah, it feels good.
Yeah. Speaking of feeling good, I was teasing Susan when she sat down because on the front of the book you have Michelle Alexander's name, who blurbed this, did the forward for it. On the back of the book, there's a wonderful piece by Brian Stevenson. I told her, when you stuck between Michelle Alexander and Brian Stevenson, it don't get no better than that. I mean, there are no two people in this country who I respect more than Michelle Alexander and Brian Stevenson. They both love you. They've both written about you in this text. But Michelle Alexander referred to you as the 21st century Harriet Tubman. And I saw Nick Kristof use that same phrase in his column in the New York Times.
Yes.
That you are the 21st century Harriet Tubman. And that's high cotton. That's a lot of love and a huge accolade. But I raise it not to embarrass you, but to ask you whether or not your work feels Harriet Tubman-ish. Do you feel like you're on a journey to rescue people and to save lives?
I know.
And to take folk to freedom.
I know.
Yeah.
That what I do rescues people, allows them to have an analysis of what's happening mm-hmm. in their lives, and breaks them free of the criminal justice system. And, you know, when we talk about slavery, you know, we have to go back to the 13th Amendment that says you can be a slave if you're incarcerated. So does it feel like Harriet Tubman? I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't imagine that mm-hmm. when I started out. I just thought if I could help a handful of women come home, it would be okay. But then I started looking at the larger picture and the systemic oppression that we can pay $60,000 a year to cage somebody up and then spit them back out into the community with nothing. Yeah, I'm going to lead them to freedom. I have a safety net and a place to bring them to help them get back on their feet and break free of incarceration and slavery. So, Michelle Alexander,
mm-hmm.
Brian Stevenson, and the cherry on top is John Legend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know what? I got 18 comebacks on that. I suspect that I ain't gonna ask you to comment on this in the 20 seconds I have left, but I suspect it won't be long, given that we live in Hollywood, before somebody buys the rights and before it becomes a movie. So get the book now before the movie comes out about a life and legacy ongoing and well-lived. The book is called Becoming Ms. Burton, From Prison to Recovery to Leading the Fight for Incarcerated Women. And you're just doing great work, and I know that the more people hear about the work you're doing, the more they're going to support it, because the work you do don't come cheap. It takes money to do this.
It takes money to do this.
And I know people are going to be supporting you more and more in the coming months and years, so God bless you. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley, novelist and poet Sherman Alexie. He's published more than 24 works. His latest is a memoir called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. It's a collage of essays and poems about his childhood on the Spokane Indian Reservation and his complicated relationship with his mother. Sherman, good to have you on the program.
Great to be back, Tavis.
I'm curious as to how you felt when you saw the cover art, but when I saw it, that broken frame, the photo in the center, and that title, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. Before I even got into this thing, it hit me.
It made me cry the first time I saw the cover art.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the first draft of the cover art.
Yeah.
It was so perfect. And it made me cry. And that is not me on the cover with my mother. That is my big sister. And the broken frame and two women who died. My big sister died in a house fire. My mother died in July of 2015 of cancer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it is a photo of a mother and daughter and who are gone. And the loss, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which is a Dusty Springfield song, one of the sadder songs ever recorded. And so the entire holistic, it just encapsulates all my grief in one image.
Why did you go with that title?
You know, I searched and searched and searched, and then I looked up the top 10 hits of my birth year, 1966. Uh-huh. And You Don't Have to Say You Love Me was number two. And as soon as I read it on the list, I remember hearing it from my youth, and my mom sang a lot. Yeah. So my mom was always singing the top 40 songs. So I remember her singing You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. And in fact, as soon as I titled that, then I started remembering other songs she used to sing that I include in the book. You know, she sang I'm Not Lisa by Jesse Coulter. She sang a lot of Linda Ronstadt. She sang Dolly Parton. So the idea of naming this book after a pop song just seemed perfect.
Yeah. There's a piece on page 113, I think, a piece that I want you to read because I think it probably encapsulates pretty nicely what this story is that you tell in the book. But the piece is called Utensil, and I wonder if you'll read it for me.
Utensil. While feasting on venison stew after we buried my mother, I recognized my spoon and realized my family had been using it for at least 42 years. How does one commemorate the ordinary? I thanked the spoon for being a spoon and finished my stew. How does one get through a difficult time? How does a son properly mourn his mother? It helps to run the errands, to get done. I washed that spoon, dried it, and put it back in the drawer. But I did it consciously, paying attention to my hands, my wrists, and the feel of steel against my fingertips. Then my wife drove us back home to Seattle, where I wrote this poem about ordinary grief. Thank you, poem, for being a poem. Thank you, paper and ink, for being paper and ink. Thank you, desk, for being a desk. Thank you, mother, for being my mother. Thank you for your imperfect love. It almost worked. It mostly worked, or partly worked. It was almost enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me get myself together here. Why was your mother's love imperfect?
Like many Native American women now and in the past, she was a target for all sorts of violence and oppression and racism and misogyny. And I think the pain she endured growing up prevented her in some ways from being able to fully express her love, from being able to fully trust the world. So I think in some ways she was not built to be a mother. Mm-hmm. It was more like blue collar labor for her, I think. I think she had to concentrate. Mm-hmm. And the thing she ended up being, the thing she could do was she was dependable. She was a worker. My father was a random alcoholic. My mother sobered up and became the breadwinner. She was the one who paid the bills. She was the one who bought the grocery. She was the one who kept the electricity on. So in a lot of ways, she ended up being my mother and my father. Mm-hmm. She ended up fulfilling every gender role inside of our family. And she did it without being very affectionate. I can remember her hugging me twice in my life. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to talk about a mother that way, of not having an affectionate mother. And I get very jealous when I meet people who have or have had affectionate mothers. I did not.
Mm. This is real sensitive territory for you because you wrote it, and for me for different reasons. But I wonder whether or not you think your mother was. I don't want to color the question. Why do you think your mother was not affectionate? Was it wasn't intentional?
I think because of the abuse, because mm-hmm. she was sexually abused, because she was raped. I think it cut off a part of her emotional life. Mm-hmm. I think it prevented her from fully expressing herself emotionally. I think her scar tissue was very deep.
Mm-hmm. Did your siblings feel the same way?
It's interesting, in writing the memoir, and as I was writing it, I was calling my sisters a lot, my brothers less so, but my sisters a lot, to fact check myself, to test our memories against each other. And in writing the memoir, I came to realize that my siblings were much better children than I was, and that my mother was a much better mother to them. And what I've come to realize is that my siblings, my brothers and sisters, are far more like my father, who was a very passive, gentle person. Mm-hmm. And my mother was this arrogant, opinionated, domineering, aggressive, ambitious person, and I'm very much like her. And also, I think she was undiagnosed bipolar, and mm-hmm. I am diagnosed bipolar. So I think, as I say in the book, that we lived our lives on parallel roller coaster mm-hmm. tracks. So I think we were built to fight each other.
When you say that your siblings were better children, by that you mean what, Sherman?
They were more affectionate. Mm-hmm. They stayed. They saw her more. They took care of her more. They were there for her. They were far more dependable mm-hmm. and far more of an everyday presence in her life than I was.
Is that an indictment against yourself?
I would call it that, yes.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things in writing a memoir, I didn't want to come off as heroic. Mm-hmm. I wanted this memoir to be about the ways in which I failed my mother, as well as the ways in which I think she failed me. And I did fail her. You know, at some point, no matter how bad a mother she was to me as a child, at some point as an adult, I chose to be a bad son. I chose not to pursue forgiveness. I chose to keep my anger precious. And so in that way, I failed her.
By keeping your anger precious, you mean?
Holding on to it, mm-hmm. valuing it, making my anger toward her such a part of the way I lived in the world that I couldn't see any other alternative. I couldn't forgive. I couldn't forget. I couldn't let it go.
The obvious question, as you well know, is, well, what happened? What happened if you indicted yourself into your adulthood? What happened to make you even want to, much less sit down to write it, but even want to dig into your past?
Well, my mother died in July 2015, mm-hmm. and poems just roared out of me, about 75 poems in about a month. And I'd never written about her. I'd only written fiction before. This is my first nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And I'd never written about her, even in fictional form, not really. She was always absent from my work. I was mm-hmm. scared of her. I was scared of her magic and her power and her rage and her love. And when she died, it gave me permission to start thinking about her. And one of the amazing things I realized is I'd spent my whole career thinking my father was the primary engine behind my storytelling. He was the one who talked. He was the one who went on long drives with me and told me stories about his childhood. He was the one who gave me autobiography, and my mom didn't. But in writing the memoir, I realized that she, the artistic force, you know, she was one of the last fluent speakers of our tribal language. I mean, they're resurrecting it now, but she was one of the last old-time mm-hmm. speakers. She was a powwow dancer. She was a powwow person. She was traditional. She was one of the elders in the tribe, all this knowledge. She was the one who most directly connected to thousands and thousands of years of tribal traditions, storytelling traditions. Mm-hmm. And I never thought of her that way until after she was gone.
How much of your relationship, or lack thereof, with your mother had to do with what you referenced a moment ago, Sherman, and that is your fear of her, your being scared of her?
Oh, her judgment, not being good enough, not being loved enough, not loving her enough. I never felt like I measured up to her. And the thing is, because of her, what I think was her bipolar disorder, she was completely emotionally unpredictable. So she could rage at you for no reason. She could be tender. She would work all night on quilts to make money so we'd have food to eat. So she was incredibly dedicated to one thing at a time or to everything at a time. And you could never get a handle on her. And it was just easier to run away from her than it was to be in her presence.
I don't know that I discovered this going through the text, going through the book. But how much of the difference, you mentioned your sisters and brothers, but how much of the difference in the relationship between you and your mom had to do with your gender? I'm just trying to get at, you know what I'm getting at here. Your sisters had a different rapport with your mother.
And my brothers had a different.
Yeah.
I had a really tough time writing this book and being honest about my mother. I was very worried that it would come off as being misogynistic, mm-hmm. that it would become us of a son being mad at a woman, at mm-hmm. a man being mad at a woman. Mm-hmm. So I was very concerned about that. But I think it was less about gender and more about that we shared a mental illness. I think it ends up being that she and I were the most alike. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we fought so often. I've always thought of myself as being my father's son. Mm-hmm. But one of the working titles of this memoir was my mother's son. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I've discovered that I am, mm. that she is my primary parent.
If your mother was undiagnosed bipolar, as you believe she was, and you've already acknowledged that you are diagnosed
yes.
bipolar, I don't know that there's a real answer to this question. I'm going to ask it anyway,
mm-hmm.
which is, if you could go back and change anything about that relationship, do you know what that would be?
I write about it in the book. One of the things I really realized, I don't think my mother was ever adored.
Yeah.
And being a Native woman, mm-hmm. from her generation, any generation, nobody adored her. And I think if somebody had adored her, if there had been people there to adore her, that she could have been somebody incredible, amazing. She had all these gifts and talents and ambitions. And I think if somebody had been there to protect her, if somebody had been there to protect her dreams, to protect her soul and her heart, I think she would have been magnificent.
I say this respectfully, but that's a lot of baggage to carry through life. As if you didn't already know that. That's a lot of luggage, Sherman.
Yes.
When, where, how did you come to believe, accept, or become courageous enough to know, or to convince yourself that with all that baggage, you could still be a worthy partner in a relationship?
I'm still working on that. You'd have to ask my wife.
Yeah, sure.
But I've been married for 24 years.
Yeah.
I've been married for almost half my life, so I think I'm doing okay.
Something's working.
And
but that might, I mean, I don't know. You tell me, was that ever intimidating?
Yes. Yeah. I'm married to an Indigenous woman.
Yeah.
I married a Native American woman. We have two sons, and often, I mean, my wife is also an incredibly powerful, magnetic, charismatic person, and at times she scares me and intimidates me in similar ways. Mm-hmm. But in writing this book, and writing about my relationship with my wife and meeting her and sharing this journey with her, with my mother's death and with examining my mother's death, I think we've become closer.
Mm-hmm.
And she read, I didn't let her read the book
until
I was done. Mm-hmm. And she read it. And the thing she said is, the first thing she said is, I feel cherished.
Mm.
And I thought, well, good, because you are.
Mm. Maybe you said more than that. You don't have to say any more if that's all you want to say. But it seems to me that if your wife, given all that you've described to us about your mother and what she did not feel, what she did not receive, if your wife reads your manuscript and she says nothing else other than I feel cherished, that's got to feel like, that's powerful. That's arresting. I mean, it's like.
My most important audience.
Yeah.
My most important reader, the most important person in my life. And I wrote something that honors her, and she feels honored.
Yeah.
So, yes.
So my point is, there's obviously one less Native woman who was made to feel the way your mother felt.
I hope so, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think my sisters as well, little sisters, they're twins. I think I'm loving the reviews, and people talk about how funny and mm-hmm. smart and witty they are in the book, and how they challenge me,
mm-hmm.
and they contradict me, and they mock me.
Mm-hmm.
I think their power comes through in the book as well, my amazing sisters.
And you, talk,
and Shelley Boyd, who was the wife of one of my best friends who died, and she's learning the language and became very close to my mother. And I think her power and her efforts to speak Salish again and to establish a school to teach younger people to speak our tribal languages again. So I think the power of women is in the book.
Yeah. Speaking of the power of women, we talked about one of those women on the front of the book, your mother.
Yes.
Tell me about the other.
My big sister, Mary, my half-sister, who was this, you know, as I say in the book, my memories of her are of this incredibly romantic figure. I mean, she ran away to Haight Ashbury in this, in the 70s and got pregnant. And she's incredibly beautiful, like my mother, and smart and charming. And I didn't know then that romantic heroes are often aimless nomads in disguise. And my sister died in a drunken house fire with her husband when I was 14. So it was one of the major deaths in my life, one of the major griefs. And she was the first person who ever told me I could be a writer. I had written a little short story in fourth grade, a Halloween story. And she read it, and it scared her, she said.
Mm-hmm. Mission accomplished.
Yes.
If a Halloween story scares you, you did your job.
Yeah. You know, and at that point, as a poor reservation Indian kid, the idea of becoming a writer, the idea of becoming anything seemed like going to the moon or going to Mars. Mm-hmm. So the fact that my sister said that to me all those years ago resonated. And she died the year I left the reservation school to go to the white high school on the border. Mm-hmm. I lost 8 people in 2 years, a close relative. So it felt like a curse, like me leaving had caused it to happen. Of course, that's a narcissistic way of looking at it. But it's hard not to look at it that way when you're 14 and 15 years old.
I'm not so sure that's narcissistic. I'm reminded now of the great, the late great Maya Angelou.
Yeah.
And I know why the caged bird sings. You know her story, that she went quiet because she thought her voice had killed the man who had raped her. And I didn't see that as narcissism any more than I see this as narcissism. I don't see it that way at all. But speaking of your leaving to go to the white high school outside the reservation, for those of us who are fans of your work and know indeed some of the trouble you've gotten into with people, some schools won't let your book be read.
Yes.
Your part-time Indian notion has got you in some hot water here and there. But I wonder how much of this relationship with your mom, or lack thereof, the stories you tell in this beautiful book, how much of that influenced your decision to get off the reservation, and whether or not revisiting that childhood has made you rethink a decision, obviously, that you can't change at this point, but have you rethought that decision?
Well, my mom always, you know, half in admiration and half insultingly, always said I was born with a suitcase in my hand, that I was always leaving. Mm-hmm. And my sisters, during the course of writing this book, said that to me in various ways too, that they always knew I was leaving. So I think I was born to leave. Mm-hmm. And I've lived in the city now for 25 years, and I realized that a lot of my sadness as a kid certainly had a lot to do with poverty and alcohol addiction and my mental illnesses and all the brain surgeries I had. But I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I was born to live in the city. We often think of Native Americans as being born to live, you know, in the wilderness, in the forests, in the deserts, closely connected to nature. But I think I was born to live in crowds. I'm happiest in crowds.
Can you leave your people without leaving your people? And when you leave your people, can they accept that you're not leaving your people?
When you come from a very specific tribe like I do, I think you do leave your people. And then I think you spend the rest of your life reclaiming pieces of what you left behind. And I think every one of my books is an effort to reclaim something I left behind. And I think this book is an effort to reclaim my mother.
As you reclaim your mother, what do you intend to do with her?
I'm just starting that ceremony. Mm-hmm. I realized writing the book was the first half of this, and now going out into the world with it, talking to you, talking to audiences, having people read it, responding, and thinking. And hearing other people's stories about their relationship with their mothers, I think that's where I'll be carrying her mm-hmm. into all these other stories I'm going to hear.
We talked a little bit, Sherman, about about how your life has impacted your relationship with your wife. We talked a bit about that. I'm curious to know how it's impacted your choices as a parent. Based upon your backstory, what kind of parent did you want to be? And have you become that, or are you becoming the kind of parent you wanted to be?
Well, we have two sons. You can't predict, you know, mm-hmm. who you're going to have. We have two sons. So I certainly wanted to raise them to be very respectful of women, mm-hmm. to be very respectful of Native women in particular. And I think we've done that. I wanted kindness above all else. Kindness. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have kind men. And I think my wife and I have done a good job.
So that's not oxymoronic,
no.
to be kind and a male.
Exactly.
Okay.
Kind men.
Yeah.
Kindness overall.
Yeah. Yeah. All these years later, I've spent some time on reservations here or there for interviews and other events. It was a Standing Rock last year,
yeah.
as a matter of fact. What's your sense of how much better, worse, the same women today are treated on the reservation?
You know, Native American women, socially speaking, deal with more violence, more poverty, more social problems than any other group of people in the United States and Canada. Mm-hmm. They are the primary targets of so much hatred and so much animosity within and from inside and outside the communities. And that has gotten better somewhat, at least mm-hmm. there's more voices talking about it, but it still persists. In fact, in Canada, you know, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of Indigenous women who've gone missing. And you know, every day I see on the internet, somebody else has gone missing. Mm-hmm. So it continues to be an epic problem for Indigenous women. And we need to continue to speak about it, to use our voices to promote the voices of Indigenous women and their stories and their power, and to celebrate and honor them and to listen.
It's a powerful book. It's called You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. It's a memoir by the brilliant award-winning writer Sherman Alexie, winner of the National Book Award.
For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.